similar formats.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Ron Regier. Ron Regier has been a UFO researcher for more than 40 years, and he is a retired aerospace engineer with 30 years' experience at Douglas Aircraft and Aerojet Electrosystems, working on space and space surveillance systems. He is MUFON co-state director for Utah and a MUFON research specialist in space satellite technology. Two of his major areas of contribution in UFO research are satellite detection of UFOs and the analysis of photos and other data associated with the Roswell crash, including the famous Ramey memo. I've had the pleasure of meeting Ron in person and have also had the good fortune to hear him speak at several of the conferences. Ron will be speaking this year in Roswell at the Roswell UFO Museum. And welcome, Ron. Boy, that's a lot of stuff to keep you busy.
Yeah, thank you very much. One correction, Dee, and I just want the audience to know I'm no longer co-state director of Utah. I was promoted or demoted or lateral change, however you want to look at it. I'm now deputy director of research for MUFON International, so I have to update my resume a little bit there.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're working on, just formed a team to investigate abductions and experiencers and put that together, and they'll be presenting their charter at the MUFON Symposium this summer in San Jose. So it's kind of exciting times getting that started.
Oh, how interesting.
Because we've had... Well, we always figured if you want to find out about something, talk to somebody that's experienced it directly as opposed to this what we have been doing. So the goals are to speak with abductees and experiencers and try to learn more about this phenomenon. And by going directly to the source or as close as we can get, we figure we can get better information that way.
Exactly. That's pretty much what we in ICAR have been doing. It's contactees researching other contactees.
So it all
works out.
Yeah, I think so.
One thing I was very, very interested in hearing more about, you gave me a little bit of teaser on it in our email correspondence here. May 24th, UFO and satellite event. Now, like I was saying, this is an incident I have never, ever heard of.
It's probably still classified, although it was classification was compromised somehow. This I used to be in charge of writing the 60-day report, and that was a report that documented the activity of the previous 60 days of operation of one of our nation's premier spy satellites, the Defense Support Program. And as such, I had to gather the information and prepare the report detailing what had happened. One of the events that happened was that we had detected something coming in from deep space at about 25,000 miles per hour, and it came into our atmosphere past our satellite. Our satellite's 23,000 miles up, so it's kind of up there, kind of high. And this thing came through and slowed down to about 11 to 12,000 miles an hour. Lingered for a little bit, followed the curvature of the Earth, and then went right back out into deep space. Things don't do that. They come in. We have meteors and meteorites coming in all the time that go into deep space, you know, from deep space, go into the Earth's atmosphere, and as a result, crash and burn. They're called meteors. They happen all the time. This didn't do that. It turned, slowed down, went back out again. It takes 17,000 miles an hour to get escape velocity. So it would have been a secret, nobody ever heard of it event, except for the fact that I received a fax from Joe Stafula, who was the former MUFON New Jersey State Director. And in it, he said, I have information that a DSP platform detected an object with heat in the 9,000 kilowatts per radiating range, which is pretty hot, coming out of deep space and passing within 3 kilometers of the DSP. Its star tracking telescope detected the object used to ensure we're in the correct position by tracking stars. Observation lasted 9 minutes. A detailed investigation failed to explain what caused the sensor readings other than a real object. Then he asked, do these systems have these capabilities? So he faxed that to me, and I was at home. And so I've got an awkward problem. I've got what I know is, at that time, secret information in my possession. So I put it in a bag and put it underneath my pillow and took it to work the following day and took it to the head of security. Joe also faxed the actual page from the 60-day report. And I knew it was legitimate because several months ago I prepared that very same page. Well, security didn't believe me, so I took them down to the vault, pulled the originals out of the vault, and showed them that this page that I'd received a fax of was precisely the same as this object that I'd received from Joe Stafula via fax. So the next thing you know, I'm in security being investigated for failing to secure classified information. And my concern was, how did Joe Stafula get it? You know, I don't know that Joe believed it was classified or anything, but at least he asked legitimate questions and he had legitimate information. And somewhere he got this page. Now, he had to have got it from one of 10 different sources because we knew the distribution list. So anyway, I'm sitting there in security, and I finally got fed up, and I says, look, I'm not going to be the subject of any investigation. I said, you're shooting the messenger instead of going after the leak. So I walked out, fully expecting I was going to get fired. The next day I came into work, and the security guard says, Ron, what did you do? I says, nothing really. And they says, well, so-and-so, who was the guy that was in charge of my investigation, got fired, and the boss was reprimanded, head of security was reprimanded, and I never could find out any more information other than this was extremely sensitive. About 2 years later, I think it was 2000 or 2001, I was approached by an Air Force colonel, a full colonel, who said, I heard about your little debacle there, and I want to provide you something. And he said, come up to my room. So I went up to his room, and he handed me a sketch that was had previously been marked classified secret and was downgraded. And I says, what's this? And he says, that's the object your DSP saw. And I says, where'd you get this? And he says, well, you guys aren't the only ones up there looking at things. So it's twin-lobed vehicle, discoidal, but twin lobes, sort of like two Ds back-to-back, if you will. So that was a May event that I thought was really intriguing. So that's the story, and I don't think it's ever gone out anywhere. So you've got an exclusive here.
Well, actually, believe it or not, and I have to thank my husband David for this. He searched the internet and found an Omni magazine article from August of 94. And it was on Fastwalkers. The title of it is DSP Satellites and the Fastwalker Incident by Dennis Stacey and Patrick. And I'm not sure I can pronounce his name correctly.
Oh, Patrick Huyge. H-U-Y-G-E. Patrick Weech. No, I'd I'm all about that interview.
They put May 5th as the date for this incident, but what I thought was rather humorous about the whole thing was Philip Klass tried to pass it off as an SR-71 Blackbird. Now,
I don't know. They don't go that high.
he put it that this object was at 80,000, had come down to 80,000 feet, and, you know, this is what they said in this article. It came from space, leveled off to 80,000 feet for a while, and then went back off into space. I'm sorry, but an SR-71 Blackbird can't do that.
That's right. Yeah,
you know, I mean, typical Philip-class, faux pas here. Oh, and then he also said if it wasn't SR-71, it was probably, and I quote, its Soviet counterpart, assuming the Soviets had one at the time. Well, even if it was Soviet, if the Soviets had a comparable aircraft, it can come from space and then back out.
Right. It's a physical impossibility. Phil and I went round and round about that. And I no longer had the page of the classified document because it was classified, and I'd returned it in security. But it was one of those things that Phil probably went to his grave. Sure, he was correct. And what can we say? He was Phil class, and there'll never be another one like him.
Thank God.
But we need Phil classes in this world. They help keep some people on their toes. He did get a little bit carried away, and I think his character assassinations were always out of order.
Well, and I also feel that, you know, you can't use an explanation that doesn't fit the data.
Right.
And he did that quite a bit.
Yes, he did. He was one of the world champions at that. But it was an interesting footnote in history that I wish we'd be able to find a little bit more out about. I was there for 30 years working with it, and everything was clamped down. We had about, over the course of time, we probably had, 10 to 20 of these fast walkers each month, and that continued for as long as I was there, and I'm sure it's continuing to this day. It's just a matter of there are a lot of things out there that we just really don't know what's going on.
And also, getting to that part, if I can find my right note for it. My husband David was reading, you know, what you said by how many of these objects spotted per hour and per day, or, you know, like one per hour, and he come up with a total. And he said, you know, it makes you think. Maybe Ryan Wood's estimates on how many crashes there have been isn't too far off.
I don't think so. I think he's fairly accurate on that. One of the things that we want to always remember is the Roper poll, I think it was, several years ago, where they interviewed people throughout the United States who claimed to have been abducted. And if we get those numbers and look at them, we find out that it's about the equivalent of the state population of the state of Iowa being abducted every year.
Oh, my.
And that's just in the United States. Now, if we expand that to the rest of the world, as we know, the rest of the world is, there's people in all parts of the world being abducted. Now we have maybe billions of people being abducted per year. And the quantity of craft that would be required to do that is absolutely phenomenal. So I don't see that these numbers are anywhere but conservative. I don't see them as way out numbers of, oh, somebody's got to be on some kind of funny substance to be able to come up with that many. I think it's very realistic numbers.
Well, the way he figured it out was he took one UFO per hour spotted by our latest satellite, and he applied that to the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And of that comes up to 8,760 UFOs a year. Multiply that by 50, That's a lot of craft.
Oh, yeah. And that's I think those numbers are in and of themselves conservative. I don't think they're really exaggerated at all. And that means that there's something going on other than what the prosaic explanations of picking up cattle or something like that. It's a lot of resources devoted to nasal implants and other things we hear about. It's just I just don't accept the current theories that they're here as casual observers or anything like that. I don't know why they're here, but it just seems that they're devoting a lot of resources for whatever reason and getting precious little in return.
This is true. It makes you wonder, you know, what all they are taking from here other than
yeah.
Well, I the only term I can come up with is biological samples.
Well, if they're really as good at DNA as people tell us they are, and I kind of doubt that, by the way, but assuming that they are, then once they get one sample, they've got it. They can make their own. You know, they don't have to pick up, unless we're some kind of field trip place for the intergalactic high school kids to go pick up stuff. I don't understand it. That's why we're studying it, trying to figure it all out. But it's much more than the casual observer and the tabloid readers would have us accept. And I think we can all agree on that.
Exactly. I agree with you on that point. I hate to change subjects so quick.
No problem.
But as everybody who knows me knows, I am a big on Roswell. Roswell's like the epitome, you know, the core of the whole thing to me.
Right. I think you're onto something. we're in agreement on that one, Dee.
And when I saw the work you did, and I saw this several years ago on the Rainy Nemo.
Right.
In the James Bond Johnson photograph, and even how the original negatives were located at the university there.
Yeah, it's a interesting story. It's too bad Bond passed away. I think it's been almost 2 years now, and he was a good man and interesting to talk to, and the only difference where we had disagreement was he always claimed he was the only photographer, and yet we know now that he didn't take all the photographs. I mean, we always knew he didn't take all of them because we had the Air Force photograph of the warrant officer that we know was taken by someone in the Air Force. But we did a forensic analysis of the photographs, and it turns out there were two different focal length lenses used, which would have been, and they're so close together in focal length, it would have been nonsensical for any photographer to go through the histrionics necessary to switch lenses on the camera they were using, speed graphic camera. So we know there were two photographers in the Ramey office, and the photographs that Bond Johnson took were probably the ones that he remembered at first blush taking, and that was the photograph of General Ramey and Colonel Dubose. Bond originally did not remember taking any photographs of Major Marcel. And I think he's correct, because those were taken with a camera lens that had a different focal length. So it's highly unlikely that Bond took those pictures.
Well, coming from the standpoint of someone who's into photography, yeah, it can be cumbersome switching lenses quickly.
Well, and on a speed graphic, even more so, because I don't know if you're familiar with the speed graphic, but the speed graphic...
It's a medium format camera, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
It's a medium format, or a large format.
It's a 4x5, a 4x5 format, bellows operated, so when it changed lens, and the viewfinder was a wire bale that fit up in front, and on top of the camera, and so when one changed lenses to be able to get a good idea of where the image would be, one also had to change the wire bail, so it's like looking through the viewfinder so you could see what was going to be precisely within your image. So it was a matter of carrying around an extra lens, and these were like 10 millimeters apart, which, as you're probably well aware, on a large format camera, that would make no sense at all.
True.
If he was going to go from wide angle, if, let's say, he brought his telephoto and says, "Well, the office is too small, I've got to switch to a wide angle," then we could understand that, but not switching that close of lens, it just doesn't make any sense. And so that doesn't degrade any of the images, though. The images are still represent what they represent, and that is, after years of looking at them, probably more carefully than anybody else, I can with absolute assurance say that there's nothing in those photographs that is from a Rawan or a Mogul weather balloon. Not that there's some, I'll repeat it, there is nothing in any of those photographs that is from a Rawan or Mogul balloon train. So, and I know that's a substantially challenging statement to make, and I'll stand by it. And I have, and we've had some merry debates, but the problem is the people that are arguing haven't really spent the time to look at the images, and that's what it takes. It takes hours and hours and hours of looking at the images. And after they're doing it, they'll agree that there's stuff that's too thick, there's stuff that's what they call the balloon envelope that's in back, that's sort of in the back of the photograph, that's not balloon material. It's got what looks to be maybe solder dripping down it, balls of what may be molten metal that leave a track. That, you don't get that from a Rawan balloon.
And then we're on some of the pieces that have been said to be strips of balsa wood. Haven't you been able to enhance that and see that there's some kind of markings on that, and that it showed that to Marcel Jr.?
No, there's markings on the one piece. We call it the I-beam, because it looks like an I-beam. No mystery there. And there's other pieces where we find that the beams, instead of being balsa wood, are hollow. There weren't any hollow pieces of that size there. I mean, there's absolutely nothing in any of the photographs that would be from a Rawan. There's just nothing there. The Air Force provided their, I think it's 600 or 700 page tome on what is in there and in those photographs, and what is in the Mogul balloon train, more than you ever wanted to know about it, and nowhere in there was there anything like what they talk about. It's just the photographs don't support the argument that they're trying to make. And so I can only conclude that I'm not going to say it was a UFO that's in there. They might have pulled some junk out of a storeroom. But it wasn't part of a Mogul. And it was definitely something else. That's all I can, with any degree of honesty, say about it. It wasn't what the Air Force said, so we know they lied again, I guess is the best way to summarize.
True. Now to get down to the part that I just found absolutely amazing. For those who aren't familiar with a large format camera, as Ron said, it is a very large negative. It's, what, 5 inches by what, 4?
Yeah, 4 by 5 inches.
Which is a good size negative. And at that close range, you'd have pretty darn good resolution. And you were able to read part of the message on the paper in Ramey's hand.
Now, if we look at one of the photos, there's a photo. I have 16 by 20 prints. So let's give a little bit of history on this. We're convinced that James Bond Johnson took these photos with General Ramey and Colonel Dubose. They were taken in General Ramey's office. Setting the stage, He's Bond is about 8 foot away from General Ramey and Colonel DuBose. They're kneeling on the floor in back of a pile of stuff. The pile of stuff is laid on brown wrapping paper, and in the background we can see another package underneath the chair. We can see a radiator, the gentleman's tie and hat. There's a picture of General Eisenhower on the back wall, and there's some flower print curtains through which we can barely see something that later on became the subject of a lot of investigation. And so in the 16 by 20 black and white print, in about the middle, slightly to the left, we see General Ramey casually holding a folded piece of paper. It appears to be about an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper folded in thirds. And when we look at that piece of paper, we can almost read it. It's tantalizing. It's folded over so we can see the top edge of the paper, and we can see about two-thirds of it, maybe. And also, General Ramey, we can see that he's holding his glasses. I interviewed his wife, and he needed his glasses to read. He couldn't read without them. So he wasn't reading the memo yet. He had picked it up on his way in, according to Bond. His adjutant handed him this piece of paper when he walked in, and Ramey had it in his hand, fumbling it around. And the first two pictures Bond took were pictures of General Ramey by himself. We can see the paper there. The second two pictures Bond took were the pictures of General Ramey and Colonel DuBose. And it's in one of those pictures that Ramey has fumbled it around enough so that we can now read the memo. And I'll put that by distinguished individual shapes. And that portion of the memo, when I cut it out of a 16 by 20 print, fits readily inside of a 35-millimeter frame holder, like when you put 35-millimeter slides in for a slide projector.
Mm-hmm.
So but the whole memo fits with a little border around it. So to give you an idea, it's less than 1 inch. I don't recall the specific dimensions of a 35-millimeter slide, but the image area, the memo fits in there with border around it. So even on a 16 by 20 print, it's not very big. And so then what I did was I looked at that portion of it under a jeweler's loop, scanned it. We ended up with a team of about six individuals looking at it. And one of the first things after I scanned it, I made a transparency of it and projected up on the wall. That was on September 22nd. 1997. And everybody in the audience gasped because they could read Fort Worth, TEX, period. That's very, very readable. Everybody I've talked to can read that. And of course, we know that the headquarters was at Fort Worth, Texas, where the stuff was supposedly flown. So as we looked at more and more lines, we ended up with five different scans. There was a scan we got from Paul David, Tom Carey, and Don Schmidt. They did a scan. We got a scan that was from Stan Friedman. We got our own scans. I'm trying to remember who the other individuals were. But we ended up with these five different scans, and then from that, we were able to differentiate different lines of the message and read it. And we're not absolutely positive on every single thing that we've read, but we're reasonably positive on it. It's a good enough read where most researchers who have done the same thing, Tom Carey has done some outstanding work on it. Dave Rudiak has probably done as much as anybody else, and he's come up, we're in agreement with all of this. And it talks about the victims of the crash forwarded to, and again, there's parts of it missing because it's just under the fold. We can't read it.
Plus his thumb is in the middle of it.
Yeah, and his thumb's covering up, darn it. And he needs a manicure. I can say that. But it was probably the biggest smoking gun of the whole thing, and it was very, very exciting to find that. So
also didn't it mention that using a weather balloon as a suggested
would make a good cover story? Yes, it did. And that's exactly what they did use for a cover story. So it was just a very, very intriguing and challenging bit of work. And there's some of the other items we found. I'm trying to remember. I mentioned the window. We're looking through the curtains. Looking through the curtains of the window, you can barely make out what appears to be a front end of a bumper of a car. And by Jove, what it is, it's a 1941 Buick Model B sedan, which was the staff car that they had used in right after World War II, which would have been a logical staff car for there to be. And so in looking at this staff car, we then notice that there's a shadow where you can see the bumper leaves a shadow on the ground. And the angle of that shadow enabled us to calculate the time of day. So we know the time of day that the pictures were taken was approximately, I believe it was 2:30 p.m., which was quite a bit earlier than other people had speculated. So that was a lot of fun. See if I can find the looking on my computer here real quick. See if recovery operation with Oswald Disk in the next 4 hours. Expect the victims of the wreck. You forwarded to the team at Fort Worth, Texas. Powers are needed at site 2. Midday, the 509 told the newspaper the meaning of the story mission. Theory even put forth weather balloons would make, and then land crews was the last. Denver crews was the last line of the text, so followed by Temple. So there have been a lot of different renderings of this, and so far the only response I've got, I've submitted several FOIAs to the National Archives and Records Administration asking for anything to do with getting the CIA records on it. And so far I've found nothing about it. They won't respond to my FOIAs. That's been about 10 years.
That surprised me.
So it's apparently still a sore spot. And I don't know how to handle that, but I'm having an interruption here. You have to excuse me for just a minute. This is kind of an unprecedented start. I've got a... Yeah, I'm on a radio program coast to coast. I can't do any business right now.
I'm very sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just register, check it in.
Okay, I will catch up with you.
Hi, and for those who are listening, this is Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis, not coast to coast.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm back.
That's okay. That's understandable.
I didn't have any. I put a sign on the door, and people just walked into my house, and I had to do something about that.
Well,
anyway, we're finishing up the Ramey office memo, and so we calculated the time of the photographs, we submitted FOIAs, we've reached what I consider to be pretty much a dead end on the Ramey office photos. They're just, I don't know of anything else we can do or anywhere else we can go with that.
That in and of itself, just being able, you know, to get, you know, what you did from the memo, I found quite revealing that something did crash. There were bodies recovered. And that it was covered up by the story of the weather balloon.
Yeah, it's fascinating that this is the way it worked out. Urgent powers are needed. That's in it. Where we all agree with all the researchers, there's some text we all agree on that nobody, Don Burleson, I'm trying to remember all the names, Dave Rudiak, Don Smith, Tom Carey, all agree that recovery operations, and there were victims of the wreck forwarded to Fort Worth, the team at Fort Worth, Texas. Something on the disc must have, and that's all everybody agrees with, urgent powers are needed at Site 2 in New Mexico. All agree with that. Told newspapers, meaning of the story and mission. We all agree on that. Weather balloons would make is all agreed on. And land surveyor crews is all agreed upon. I mean, this is people who are in competition one with the other, and we all agree on almost everything on there, and I think it's because we can read it. And I should make note so your audience knows that there, the only manipulation, if you want to call it Emmy's manipulation, is we've done is contrast enhancement, and forgot what the other one's called, but anyway, we didn't do any pixelization, no image enhancement software at all. We just changed the brightness and the contrast. That's all we changed, and that's how we got the message. And the reason is some of it's in fairly deep shadow, and some of it's out there really bright. So if you use the same exposure settings on all of it, it washes out some. So it's a fascinating memo. And And Ramey never, I don't think he ever suspected that anybody would be able to read. I don't think he, by the time he read it, he figured, you know, it's gone. The damage control would be to ignore it, because to acknowledge it in any way would have given confirmation to it. So they were ignored. And then, interestingly enough, when the photographs were first printed by Bill Moore in his book Incident at Roswell, Bill cropped the image so that the good stuff wasn't in the image. It wasn't until we went to the University of Texas Arlington, got the real negatives and looked at them, that we could determine that there was in fact more stuff, and it was good stuff in those images that we looked at.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at the image, one of the images now, that shows, I believe it's the warrant officer in Ramey, and it's the full frame, and it has the aluminum foil spread out, and Ramey's got the thing in his hand.
Uh-huh.
And below where I'm looking at it, they're talking about different incidents involved with the analysis of this photograph, and it's saying that the Air Force had claimed that a government photo analysis lab, which was they refused to identify, had done a analysis on this to try and get out any details, and they claimed that you couldn't, that it wasn't possible.
Right, and that's what I wrote my FOIA on, and I included a simple print of the slide that I had that so everybody could read Fort Worth, Texas. And in the print, you could easily read Fort Worth, Texas in it. And so for them to make that statement, I said, it's ludicrous. And I asked for the information, and obviously nothing's ever come back. But give them time. It's been 10 years. The wheels grind slowly.
This is true. But I applaud the work that you and your team did on this. It's very valuable information, in my opinion.
Well, thank you.
It proves that something happened.
Yeah. And not only that, it's it's not the mundane sticks of balsa, pieces of aluminum foil. It's something else. And what that something else is, we don't know. But we know what it was. It wasn't what the Air Force said it was. So once more, in ufology, we have the Air Force lying to us.
Well,
when they don't have to.
Well, especially, you know, I feel really, really bad for the way it was handled for Marcel Sr.
Yeah.
They tried to say he mistook a weather balloon. Well, after reading Marcel Jr.'s book and learning of the training that Marcel Sr. received while he was in the Army Air Corps as an intelligence officer, he was trained how to identify these weather balloons. He would have known one immediately. Mac Brazel would have known it was a weather balloon, because from what I understand, he'd even participated in returning several, because there was a reward for returning them.
Right, and the pieces of equipment on those Mogul balloon trains, there's nothing on the Mogul that was classified. They were all, every piece of equipment on there was unclassified. There was nothing there that was classified. What was classified was the mission. And the mission was to listen and go up to high elevation and listen for Soviet nuclear bursts. They'd hear the boom. And so it had a simple microphone and a transponder and the balloon to carry everything up there, and some radar reflectors so they could track them on radar. And then there were some containers, some cylinders filled with sand, that as they gained altitude, what would happen is they'd get up to the top where one of the balloons would pop. They had 24 balloons on these trains, and the balloon would expand until it popped. Well, then they'd lose that lift, and the balloon train would start to drop because it outweighed more and had less lift. And so they had a little altimeter pressure gauge in there that would release sand from one of these tubes. The tube would dump its sand. Now it weighed less, and it would go high up like it was supposed to be. Until the next balloon popped, it would come down, drain the sand. And so it sort of had this bobbing up and down flight profile.
An aerial buoyancy compensator?
Yeah, there you go. And I believe that's what it was called. And that's the way the thing went. But there was nothing secret about this stuff. This was all very common. It was used. All the equipment was used in meteorological balloons, where they'd find the wind direction and other phenomena like that. It was all unclassified, and every piece of equipment on it that was reusable had a great big tag with great big bright red letters with reward and where they could return it. And so people would get these things, and they'd say, well, gee, I could make a few bucks. And this was when gas was 19 cents a gallon and food was 10 cents a loaf, and if you're a $20 reward, that would keep you in groceries for a week.
Oh, yeah.
So people would return these things, and they were used to seeing them. So there's no mistaking a weather balloon. They knew what those things were. They knew what all this equipment was. Alamogordo was flying it. Roswell Field was flying these things. All the air bases were flying them. So for the Air Force to say that this was a weather balloon, even in 1947, was extremely insulting to everybody.
True. And, excuse me, you know, and one thing about Ramey that a lot of people are unaware of is he was the head of the Air Materiel Command out of what is now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And in 1952, when there was the two weekends in a row of sightings over D.C.
Right.
In July, when they did the press conference, and the Air Force did the press conference, Ramey was there on that panel.
Yeah. Do you know who else was there? Head of Project Blue Book.
Stanford, yes.
And that was the largest press conference, the absolute largest press conference that held since the announcement of VJ Day at the end of World War II.
Well, and then Blue Book was part of the Air Materiel Command.
Right.
So Ramey was the commanding officer of Blue Book.
Yep. And Blanchard, the CO who authorized release of the Walter Hawk to release the message, later on became a four-star general and died of a heart attack while in the Pentagon. So he was not punished. There was no... He was rewarded for the way he handled it. And then the reason we got involved looking at these photographs in the first place was because General Ramey's widow was upset because her husband had been maligned for years, and she wanted his name cleared. And that's what got us started looking at these.
Oh, I didn't feel any animosity towards Ramey. He was just following orders.
Right, but there were his kids had heard that one of the problems was that he had gone out and lied, and that their father didn't lie, and they were concerned about that. And there's a difference between him out and out lying and him following orders, and that's why we were really pursuing that to find out, well, what was it, what was going on. So it was a gesture, an experience to clear this gentleman's name, who is pivotal in UFO history.
Valid point. And it's interesting that you should bring up Walter Hyde. This is a question that just popped into my mind. And out of curiosity, what do you think of the Halt affidavit?
I think it's genuine and accurate. And I think that what most people don't know is he and Doc Blanchard, his CO, he told Blanchard, as I understand it, that he would keep his secret. And he did. And he didn't tell it until after he and Blanchard were both dead. But he kept it even after Blanchard died. And I think it shows that he was an honorable man. He kept his word, even when he didn't have to, because the witness to that word keeping was no longer with us. But
well,
I believe it. I think it's true and accurate. And the reason is, his affidavit, the points we can verify and check, match the data. And so it makes sense to me.
This is true, but the problem I have with this document, okay, was he signed it in December of, what was it, 2000, oh, I forget the exact date, I think 2003. And I met him the following April.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told before I met him that I was not allowed to ask him any questions unless his daughter was there, because his memory had gotten so bad that he needed his daughter there to remind him of things.
I wouldn't say you're wrong, because you were there. I wasn't there. I don't have any... If that's true, I'm sad to hear that. But I don't know that takes away from the affidavit. It just sort of weakens the position a bit, though, doesn't it?
Well, you know, that's why I was asking your opinion of the document, as I have my doubts whether he personally wrote it or dictated it or, you know, whatever. Just my doubts.
I can understand that.
excuse me. Getting into Roswell, do you have any other projects along the Roswell line?
Not right now, other than what I'm going to present at the museum this summer at the festival. And that's possible alien influence on American Indians in the Southwest. I've got a presentation I'm going to do on that.
Yes, that's
thing about the Roswell crash.
I'm
pretty much about everything I could do until I get feet on the ground to start looking at it. As I got done on that.
That's in the Roswell conferences are just 4 weeks away.
Yes, I'm starting to get really excited about it, mainly because I haven't finished my presentation yet. I'm still working on it. But no, it's going to be. a lot of fun, I think. We're going to... it's always good to be there and meet with the staff and all of the assemblage of UFO researchers. And there's going to be some big names there. It's going to be several days of intense fun, I believe.
I'm looking forward to being there also.
Oh, good. Yeah, we're going to talk. I'm going to be there with Daryl Sims, and then we're going to do a joint workshop on this. And we have several objects. You want to talk about the... give you some teasers on the presentation, what we're going to be doing?
Well, sure. We have about 2 minutes till we go to a break.
Oh, well, let's... so those people who will be coming back, when we get back, what we'll be talking about is there a connection between the pyramids at Giza and American Indians? And if so, what is that connection? That should get them thinking a little bit, maybe. Go ahead.
That would be interesting. By chance, is the Pyramid of Giza in conjunction with Dennis Balthizer?
With Dennis?
Yes.
I haven't chatted with Dennis. I don't know what research he's doing on that.
Oh, he's real big into the Great Pyramid of Giza.
Ah, well, I'll have to make sure he shows up for the talk. It turns out the Egyptians were pikers. They got three piles of rocks aligned. The American Indians got about 12 to 15 structures in one area and about the same amount in another area. By the way, what I want you to give me a call back because my battery's getting low and I'm going to switch phones. Can we do that during the break?
Certainly. In fact, we need to start heading that direction. We'll be back here in a little while on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network and UPRN 105.8 FM, New Orleans. We'll be back in a little bit. And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And I'm your host, G. Andrew. We now have two ways to access our station with UpSnap. Text PARA, that's P-A-R-A, to the number 27627 on your mobile phone and listen to the paranormal radio on your phone. That's PARA, P-A-R-A, to the number 27627. Or call 201-765-9737 to listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Now, back to our guest, Ron Roguer. Ron, while during the break, we were discussing the Orion connection with the ancient Native American site in
yes.
the Southwest.
Yeah, it's fascinating that the Chacoan culture in the Chaco Canyon in northwestern New Mexico is the only culture we've yet found that studied with great regularity and precision both the solar and lunar phenomena. And they did that for a period of time. And one of the things I found intriguing, we've all heard about, I believe most of your audience has heard anyway, about the alignment of the Great Pyramids at Giza and how well they were aligned and how accurate the alignments were. Well, turns out in the course of this research, I found out that nothing against the Egyptian culture, but they were pikers compared with the American Indians and their alignments. We've got, because when we examine them, we can see that the Great Pyramids, they could align them with a stick and a string and look. They were all readily visible one to the other. Yet when we get to Chaco and to the Hopi Nation. These villages were separated by miles. And Chaco as much as 15 miles, yet they were aligned within a few arc seconds, which is as accurate as are the pyramids, and even more so in some instances. And I found that utterly fascinating. We've got stones that form giant observatories where they can observe the sun solstice and the moon passing. They were aware that the moon had an 18-year cycle, and we didn't know that for, I think, until the 16th century. So it's just a fascinating culture. And where did they learn this? Where did they, why did they care, was maybe another question that has to be asked. But here was a culture that, for some reason, made it a point to move multi-ton stones on top of a butte in extremely harsh weather conditions, and yet do so for the purpose of monitoring the movements of the sun and the moon. Just, it's just fascinating to me.
Now, this stone structure, is it like a building, or is it like the star wheels I've done a lot of reading about?
Okay, well, it turns out, let's take the Chaco Canyon stuff. In Chaco Canyon, there were 15 major buildings. These buildings were as much as 15 miles apart. And these buildings themselves were observatories. While I was on top of Fajada Butte, which was at one end of Chaco Canyon, there's this tall butte, several hundred feet tall, and at the top of that butte, there's an alcove, and inside the alcove, or outside the alcove, I should say, are three major slabs of rocks that weigh many tons each that are positioned such that when the solstice occurs, the sun's passes and has a dagger of light, pass right through a petroglyph that is carved onto the face of the rock. That's the only time it occurs. The rest of the time, what they call it, the sun dagger, doesn't have any effect on that, doesn't come close. But that one time, two times a year, in the summer and winter solstice, it passes right through, leaving its mark indelible on the impressionable minds of people who are watching it, and it's a fascinating thing to see. I've never seen it live; I've seen it in video. But that's on top of the mountain. We have gigantic kivas that would hold maybe as many as 500 people.
Wow!
That are also aligned such that the sun would shine through a small narrow opening into the interior of the kiva while people were gathered inside. Not in one building, not in two, but in all 15 buildings. So the buildings themselves acted as giant observatories. And it's just one thing after another. When we look at the most famous house, the house called Pueblo Bonito, named by the Spanish when they discovered it after it had been abandoned, was five stories tall. It's a five-story tall structure that was built of rock with no supporting mortar, no steel beams. Five-story structure that was built in the year 1000, thereabouts. It was built over a period of a couple of hundred years. And it was the largest building in the Americas until the 1880s. I mean, it's mind-boggling. Most people aren't aware that this is going on right here in the United States under a small corner of New Mexico. But the buildings themselves, the front wall of Pueblo Bonito, is aligned such that at the solstice, the sun is directly in line with that. At high noon, the center wall wall of the structure is perfectly aligned north and south, and the front of the building is perfectly aligned east and west. It's just amazing the way the buildings themselves form the structures that we use to measure the movements of the planetary objects like the sun, the moon, and then also some of the stars. We get into Arizona, and we find that not only do we have the belt of Orion, as we do in the Great Pyramids, but the Hopi villages and ruins, which are no longer villages, but they were at one time, emulate the entire constellation Orion. So it goes well beyond just the stars that are easily visible in the belt. They use the whole darn structure. And why did they do this?
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, and they, well, for the summer solstice and the winter solstice, wouldn't that be good indicators for them to know, well, here in a few weeks, we got to do planting?
Right. But do you have to do it on every building when they're supposedly in communication one with the other? And
I was just playing devil's advocate.
Yes, I understand. And so, but that's the question that immediately comes to my mind. Okay, we do this so that they can use it for planting, but then once you got it done with one and you look over the fence and see, well, George is planting his corn, I better plant mine. Or the shaman could easily go in, or the medicine man, or whatever term you wish to use today, and tell them, you know, it's time to plant. You don't need to do it 15 times in 15 miles. That's a small area. But they did. And then the mystery, as I studied it, got deeper and deeper, and we find out that there's the buildings who archaeologists originally said housed maybe as many as 3,000 people, maybe more, because of the size of the building. Hundreds of rooms. Turns out these rooms are never occupied. There's nobody there. They looked at the garbage dumps. You know, we look at the trash of people, because people tend to try to save things, but they don't care about their trash. The trash isn't nearly enough trash. Trash size indicates there were maybe maximum 200 people living there. And that doesn't make any sense. Where did everybody go? Well, it turns out they were never there. They were never there because, and we know that because some of the rooms have never even had a fire in them. Some of the rooms don't even have doors. So we've got a large, large multi-storied building, 5 stories tall, covers 13 acres, the largest building in America for over 1,000 years, and yet it wasn't used as a cultural center, it wasn't used as a trade center, it wasn't used as an apartment building. What was it used for? That's going to be the subject of my talk.
Interesting. I look forward to, I've got several things going on that weekend there in Roswell. You know, I hope to catch as many of the lectures there as I can. And when you consider there's 3 different lecture sites going on, that can be a logistical nightmare.
Oh, it's crazy. And that's part of the joy of being there. It's a potpourri of ufology. There's anybody that says they're going to go to Roswell this summer that comes back and say they're bored, I think they'd have a rough time at Disneyland. I mean, it's really an experience that nobody should miss if they're into the study and understanding and just the thrill of UFOs. It's a weekend of sheer delight for those of us who are involved in this sort of thing.
Oh, I agree with you on that. If they're bored their 4th of July week in Roswell, then they would be bored to tears at Disneyland. I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, there's no hope for them.
Oh, gosh, between the parade, the alien costume contest, the carnival that will be set up there, all the food vendors, like I said, the three different lecture venues, and they even usually have quite a few famous people. I mean, people from TV show up.
Yeah.
You know?
Forget who the star attractions are at the museum this year, but I won't even try to. It's on the net. Anybody that wants to go in and look at the Google the UFO, International UFO Museum, will be able to find out their guests, and there's some very interesting guests coming up. Not to mention, at the museum, I know it'll be Stan Friedman, and I know anybody that's watched any UFO shows at all has seen, knows of Stan Friedman, and he's going to be there. And what maybe people don't realize is all of these researchers, no matter where they are extremely accessible. I mean, anybody that ever wanted to get in Stan's rear pocket and ask him questions about anything and everything, Stan's not a shy person. He will more than gladly sit down with anybody and chat about UFOs for hours.
Oh, this is true.
And
he's a wealth of information.
Yeah, that's true of all the ufologists that are going to be there. Don Smith's going to be there. Tom Carey, two men who have done amazing work on the Roswell incident. Daryl Sims is going to be there. He's done more on implants than probably anybody else in the world. And he's open to all manner of discussion. He's not a bit shy. I think if there was one word that would describe Daryl, shy would not fall into any of the...
Oh, this is true.
So
I've met Daryl and had a chance to speak with him at great length. I have a question that was brought up by a member of our virtual auditorium here in Paltot.
Sure.
This one is from Leinster, and he asks, do NORAD satellite surveillance track where all the fast walkers go? In other words, inside mountains, lakes, oceans, etc. He personally hadn't heard of NORAD tracking a fast walker entering a mountain, a lake, or an ocean.
Okay, we don't know whether they enter or what happens to them. Okay, and I'm not trying to be vague. It's a matter of we're a scanning system. It's not a staring system. By that, imagine you had a string of light bulbs that were on an arm, and the arm is rotating, and you were looking out your window at this rotating arm. It would come by your window periodically, and I think the periodicity is still classified. I'm not sure. But let's just make up a number. Let's say every 10 seconds. So every 10 seconds, you'd see this blink of lights. And so every 10 seconds in this scenario, our sensor would look and see the same portion that it saw before. And so sometimes, most of the time, these things disappear between scans. And as a result, we don't really see where they go. I think everybody's seen a movie with the radar, the way the radar scans. And you see the blip, blip, blip as the light bar goes around. And that's the way our system works. And we see the energy that's reflected or emitted by the object, but we don't see the object itself. We're not a visible light sensor. We have ultraviolet and infrared. And so we see the reflections and emissions, but they're time delayed because of the nature of the scanning system. So we won't see them unless we have to just coincidentally catch it at the right moment. But we do detect them with a great degree of regularity. I hope that answers the question.
Gossamer in the room also posted a interesting idea. He said, I bet there is some technology in space, though, that can track where they go once in Earth's atmosphere. Since you worked in the satellite industry, maybe that's something that you could answer.
Yes. There is technology, and there's no doubt in my mind that they are tracking them. We can track track, via the deep space objects, we can track objects down to about, oh, I would say about 4 inches diameter.
That's small.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So we can track those small things, and we keep a good catalog of them because we don't want to put the International Space Station or the shuttle in jeopardy. So we've got a pretty good idea where everything is. And then when it comes into the atmosphere, we've got all manner of things that track them. We've got every ship in the U.S. fleet is able to track and follow objects as they come in. And the reason being, especially since 9/11, or since the USS Cole was attacked, we don't want to lose another ship. So we assiduously track all things that come in. And where we don't seem to have any information is those things that are not threats are quickly discarded. And that's the kicker in the equation. If it's not a threat to a ship, for example, then they don't look at it. They don't care anymore because it takes so much data stream to look at everything that we can't afford to keep looking at stuff that is of no interest. Now, the question in my mind has always been, well, is there somewhere looking at stuff that you and I would think would be of interest, and that is UFOs? And I think that there is. I don't have any proof of it. But I can't believe that there would not be something that would look at UFOs or look for UFOs. Just inconceivable that let that one slide, so to speak.
Oh, I know we have satellites that look towards the Earth. That's a given.
Right.
Do we have any looking the other direction?
Sure we do.
Deep space?
And you're aware of
that. Are they finding
anything?
That's
Hubble. Hubble looks out all the time. That's how we get all those beautiful images of deep space. That's Hubble looking out. But the rest of the time,
that's looking at deep space objects such as galaxies and novas and stuff. I'm speaking more looking for hardware.
Yeah, I don't believe so. I don't know of any if there is. I would think it would be foolish for us not to have. But again, I don't know that there's not an agreement. I'm not saying that there is. I'm just let's just wing this for a little bit. Why would we want to do that? Well, we'd want to find out if there was somebody regularly visiting our planet. And
I would like to know which direction you're coming from.
Well, until we figure that out, but once we figure that out, if we figure it out, then we don't have to do that anymore. And there may be some truth to the speculation that we've already cut a deal with them. I don't know. But I've in the years I worked in the business, and I'm not trying to be coy, I never knew of anything that was looking out other than Hubble and the people in the International Space Station. It would make sense that they would.
Ooh, that's an aspect I hadn't considered.
But the International Space Station is in a perfect place to check things all the time. And the shuttle and the astronauts, as you're well aware, have seen a lot of stuff that is called a question. Let's just say it's very questionable stuff. And we don't know what it is. We see images all the time of Jeff Challenger, before he passed, used to record every moment that the shuttle was up from the time they cleared the tower until wheels down on the ground. He'd record every minute of that, and he had hundreds of feet of tape of anomalous objects. And we've seen some of this as it's come out every once in a while. Jeff is no longer with us, but he had a collection that was just unparalleled. But that's of objects that were seen and watched by the astronauts, as opposed to your question about hardware that would look up or look out.
Speaking of space shuttle footage, the first time I met you, it was at the Crash Retrieval Conference in 2004.
Okay.
And you showed some footage. I believe it was STS-114.
Yes.
Okay. Here just recently on the UFO Hunters on History Channel, they did a whole hour just on astronauts and space-based reports.
Oh, okay.
And they had Dr. Jack Kasher on, who everybody who knows who Dr. Kasher is, did an excellent analysis of the STS-48 footage. They played the 114 footage for Kasher.
Uh-huh.
And he pointed out something that I hadn't noticed, and I don't think you may not have noticed, but that object isn't going in a straight line, stopping, and then going back the same direction. It's actually it's been filmed at the edge of a turn. It's going almost as if it's orbiting something. It's going in a turn and then away from the camera.
Oh, I hadn't looked at that footage since I sent off a bunch of copies after the conference. I'll have to dust off the old CD and look at it again.
I was quite amazed that he picked that up just from watching it on a TV screen.
Oh, he's a good man. I'll have to look it up because I didn't pay any attention to that earlier.
But even, and if you watch it, you go, oh, yeah, he's right. It is curving away.
Okay, that's fascinating. I'll take a look at that.
I thought that was quite interesting, and you mentioning the STS made me remember that, and I thought, oh, wait a minute, first time I saw that footage, Ron showed that.
Yeah, there's a lot of mysteries out there, and we're hoping to be able to understand more and more as we go on, but I get so disheartened sometimes because it seems like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill all the time, and I was hoping we'd have all of this intrigue and mystery solved before the next administration came in. Well, I've been hoping that each administration changed for years now, and it just doesn't seem to want to happen. But maybe the next administration will clear it up for us.
Oh, well, looking at the candidates, I don't know.
I know what you mean. They seem to have different things on their minds.
This is true.
But it's important for all of us to work together. And then the other thing is, do we really want disclosure? And the reason I say that is I've noticed if people want something, if the American people want something, we generally get it. And I don't hear a big clamoring. I hear people that want NASCAR. They got NASCAR. And
hey, now, wait a minute. I'm a NASCAR fan.
So am I. As a matter of fact, I'm TiVoing the nationwide race right now as we speak. But we seem to get what we want. We wanted to know about Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. And by gosh, we found out maybe more than some of us wanted to know. But we find out these things, and I think if there was a really serious demand from the American public to have the administration release everything they know about UFOs, I think we'd get the data. I think it would be released. And the question is, do we want that? And we say we do, because that's sort of a knee-jerk response. But there's maybe something that we don't want to know. Why are they here? I don't think they're here to do us either harm nor good. If they wanted to, they could have done either one.
Oh, a long time ago.
But they're here for some reason. And I kind of like to know what it is, but maybe I don't want to know. It's a fascinating argument. I can make a case for either way. But I do know that one of these days we'll find out, and I just hope it happens on my watch. It's one of these things that's kept me going for over 40 years in this field. trying to figure out what's going on. And I got started because theirs are faster than ours, and I was going to be an electric aeronautical engineer, and I wanted to find out how they made them go faster than we could make ours go.
Oh, one theory why the government hasn't disclosed is because if they did, that would open them up for massive class action lawsuits from all the abductees. Why didn't you protect it? That's your job. You're supposed to.
Yeah, well, that's makes sense as to, you know, if you're Secretary of the Air Force. By the way, they just fired him this week, which I was wondering if that has anything to do with disclosure.
Interesting idea.
If that's his job, he's been doing a lousy job.
Yeah.
And if it's his job, he would not tell his boss that they're here. So the lie may very well be that the president and the administration don't know what's going on. Because if the people that have the responsibility for telling them are doing a lousy job, they're not going to go to their boss and say, you know, boss, I know that they're visiting us on a regular basis, but there's not a darn thing I can do about it. So, just forget the whole mess. I don't think any president would want to keep a Secretary of the Air Force or Secretary of Defense around who couldn't provide defense.
There's another question in our virtual auditorium.
Sure.
From the Eternal Being, and he asks, how much data, if any, from weather satellites came across your desk? He says, like, I think the 400-mile DIA object from a Mexican weather satellite.
That's 400-mile diameter. I didn't get any weather data. I had no access to satellite weather data. We were strictly classified space surveillance and looking primarily for Soviet missile launches and threats to the continental United States. So, sorry to say, I don't know. I have no firsthand knowledge of any weather satellite data. I've heard the stories and the rumors, but I don't have any knowledge of it.
Oh, here's an interesting question. Who gets the Fast Walker reports?
Let's see. The Fast Walker reports are the way the system works is, let's give a little bit of history there, and that's I'll stay on point. Is all the data comes down and it goes directly to two different sites. One site is Cheyenne Mountain, and the other site is at our facility. And the reason we get it is so, if there's anything that's happening that was bad with the satellite where it's malfunctioning, we want to be able to rapidly analyze the data and find out what it was that was causing the malfunction. So that's the first two places it goes. As it comes in, there's automatic detection algorithms that determine whether or not the data that we generate are something we should be concerned about. Because there's a lot of stuff that we see that, again, is no threat to us and isn't really of any interest. It's just stuff. So we discard that. Now, then, when it gets to Fast Walkers, Fast Walker data are distributed, or come down to Cheyenne Mountain and to us, as do the other data, and those go along, and depending on what's going on with the Fast Walker, it depends on where it goes. Not everybody gets everything. The only people that get everything was our location and the Cheyenne Mountain complex. So it depends on, you know, we're not going to send out a heads up, keep your eyes open for this report to, if it came in over the East Coast, to somebody on the West Coast, because they don't have any reason to be concerned about that. So it's highly dependent upon where the Fast Walker is and where it appears to be heading. But in all cases, it goes to us and to Cheyenne Mountain. And Cheyenne Mountain makes the determination who the data are routed to from there.
Didn't I hear that they basically, for all intents and purposes, have shut down the Cheyenne Mountain and have just a maintenance crew there?
Well, the Cheyenne Mountain is the actual facility. Yeah, I think so. But they still have the functions are performed. It's just very expensive to maintain that big underground facility. But the functions of Cheyenne Mountain are still performed.
Okay. I'd heard that they had moved the actual
Peterson Air Base
in. Pardon?
Is where all of it went, but the group, I think, is still called Cheyenne Mountain, even though they're physically not inside the mountain.
Okay, that makes sense. What was the last known fast walker that you knew about?
Oh, let's see. That had any significance, I guess, would primarily if that was the Phoenix Lights, we picked that up. That was intriguing.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, we picked that up over Prescott and kept it going all the way down until it disappeared right outside of Tucson. Yeah, those were definitely not flares, as they want us to believe.
Well, I find that absolutely amazing because of so many people. You see, I live in the Phoenix area, and so many people around here saw that. And, you know, when you come up and say, yeah, we tracked it going from here to here to here to here that night, that's pretty amazing news.
Yeah, I thought that was, well, I did a monograph on that. I don't know what happened to it, but it was a fascinating series of events. It was I think it was more fascinating because the Phoenix Lights were seen over a much greater area than most people have ever known about. It didn't just remain isolated that little valley where the population center of Phoenix resides. I mean, it was went for quite a ways.
Well, from what I understand, it was seen in Nevada, coming through Arizona, and I believe off into New Mexico at one point.
Yeah, we lost track of it because of energy losses when it reached the just south and a little bit east of Tucson. But yeah, it was there, and it started out fairly bright, and it was just a really, really nice event. We also detected the remember the Salida, Colorado sighting. I'm not remembering the date on that one.
I don't either.
I think his name was Tim. Was it Tim Cooper that did that one? And objects several thousand feet wide. I mean, great big thing. We detected that one. And
speaking of size, were you able to determine the size of the Phoenix object?
No, we can. I don't. The data are classified, and I don't remember off the top of my head what they were. But we just get radiant intensities, how much energy it reflects or emits, and that will. If we know what the object is, then that can give us an indication as to its size. But let's say you might have a barbecue pit would maybe give off the same amount of radiant energy as a great big flashbulb. They would happen in different times because a flashbulb gives off all of its energy in a really, really quick period, but the barbecue pit might take an hour. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say the size of the object because all we're dealing with is radiant time intensity profiles, so much radiant energy or reflected energy over a certain period of time. And from that, it was designed originally to detect ICBMs, so it makes it not difficult, but not impossible to apply to other phenomena.
So basically, you're detecting a heat signature.
Correct.
In just a nutshell.
Correct. And that heat signature can vary dramatically by either size or the amount of energy it has.
Interesting. I'm going to have to do some more digging into this.
Okay. The whole system is explained if you were to, next time you talk to Nikki and the folks that do the videotaping of the different presentations for Laughlin and MUFON. They've got my presentation I gave on how the DSP works.
I'll have to keep my eyes open for that.
Yeah, it's an old relic museum piece now.
But, I have a collection of a video collection of so many documentaries, and I go back and I rewatch them just to keep my memory fresh.
Oh yeah, it's a never ending task, isn't it?
Yes, and it's really difficult to keep up with everything that's happening.
Oh, I'm amazed that you do as well as you do, because I don't even try anymore. I try to keep a general passing knowledge, but as far as specifics on stuff, I do my own research and try to share that as quickly and rapidly as accurately as I can. And yet at the same time, I fall behind even in my own field, and that's kind of scary for me. Is there any more questions from your audience there?
Oh, well, I've been kind of keeping an eye open, and they're all amazed over the information you gave about the Phoenix incident. The tracking of it. They're all just, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was an amazing event, and it was an exciting night. Right about the same time, we had a pilot fly, I forget what the plane it was, but crash-landed a plane that was going up to, ended up, they found it in Colorado. And that was another series that was happening right around the same time, and I know that took a lot of our energy away from investigating this. We had a small group of amateur ufologists at Aerojet that were kind of, they knew what I was into, and so they clue me in. Ron, we saw something here. That's how I found out about the Phoenix Lights. Now, they never believed it was UFO. They just said it was something weird. Got something weird here, Ron. Yeah. And they would clue me in, and I'd look at it. And the one in Colorado came back as we saw a forest fire, but it was really bizarre for a forest fire. It didn't have much energy, so it must have been really small trees. Well, that, as it turns out, was this gigantic UFO that was spotted by several hundred people in the Salinas Valley. So it was another one of these where they thought they were having fun with me, and it turned out to be a real UFO.
That's kind of strange, because isn't it slightest that did the restaurant owner?
Yeah, that's right. That's the restaurant owner that saw it, but it was, first seen as all the reports went in as being a forest fire, and that was what was bizarre. Was when he was seeing it, people were seeing a real thing. When the sheriff went out to respond to the forest fire and got the coordinates that came from our satellite to go look at the forest fire, he couldn't find anything.
Wow.
So, because by then the UFO had flown out of sight. But there was an attempt to follow up and say, well, gee, we've got these data. We've got a forest fire. Why don't we do something with the data to help somebody? So we called it into the sheriff's office, and as it turned out, he couldn't find anything. And NORAD gave him different coordinates to look at.
Well, I have a question on this. In our virtual auditorium, Gossamer asked anything was picked up during the Hudson Valley sighting.
I don't recall that we did, but I couldn't say that we didn't. And the reason being, I had a sample of about 500 pages of data that I was able to go through and look at. And of those 500 pages, I didn't see anything in the Hudson Valley, but I would be shocked if we didn't have. I just didn't have it. And the reason is I was bounced back and forth from one portion of this program to another. And, for example, I wrote the 60-day report for a period of about 2 years, and they were not during the Hudson Valley incident. So if it had happened during my time when I was doing it, yes, definitely I'd have seen the data and reported on it, but it didn't.
So what year did you start working with this system?
I started working with it in 1969.
Wow. It makes you wonder how many objects were tracked.
Oh, tens of thousands. No question in my mind about that. But again, we have no way of knowing what all of these objects were. We can get close approximations, but we can't always differentiate precisely what they were. For example, if we go back to Phil Klass, we might have something that's approximating the speed of an SR-71. And so over a period of time, we would, and this was a difficult thing to do, to coordinate with the Air Force and the CIA as to, well, when are you guys flying these things and where? So that we could then get these data and correlate and see if there was correlation, if there really was an unknown, or if it was just another SR-71. So over a period of years, it took us to develop this database that we worked on more and more and more and refined it so that we could get better and more accurate approximations of what it was we were seeing. And still it's an inexact science because we're looking through 23,000 miles of atmosphere. And it's sort of like, to give you an idea, if you were to, I think everybody's looked at a sunset. You can pretty well look at a sunset with an unaided eye and not have any long-lasting effects. But if you try to look at the sun at high noon, it's dangerous and you'll probably burn your retina and you might go permanently blind. And the reason is we've got of approximately 25 miles of atmosphere to look through when we're looking at the sunset and sunrise. But at high noon, we don't have that much atmosphere to look through. And so the satellites have to look through that same amount of atmosphere to spot objects on or near the Earth's surface. So the farther out toward the edge they are, the less atmosphere, or very, very straight down, we can see pretty good. So, but in between, we have a real rough time because we go out the far edge, we're looking through the edges of the atmosphere where we're out in deep space, and we try not to look too far because there's nothing out there. But when we look straight down, we can see pretty darn good, and that's where you get the old saw that, well, we could read the image on a newspaper from deep space. Well, yeah. When we're looking straight down and conditions are right and there's no clouds and no viewing problems. So we can see all these objects, but we can't always identify them.
We are about, we're running over just a little bit on time. If you'd like to mention where you're speaking,
I'll be speaking at the Roswell International UFO Museum on the 4th, 5th, and 6th of July, and I look forward to meeting everybody, and come by and say hello. The museum admission last year was free. I believe it'll be free this year, and it's a great experience for anybody to come. I sure want to see y'all.
And your website address?
I don't have a website.
Oh my.
I just kind of do my thing and make presentations at different venues when I'm invited, and I'd rather devote my time to doing research than self-promotion, to be honest with you.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and speaking with us this evening.
Now, if there's anybody out there in the listening audience who wants to work with me and do a website, I'll be more than glad to work with them, but I just don't have the time or knowledge to do that. So I want to thank you for having me as your guest, and I really enjoyed it, and I look forward to doing it again one of these days.
Oh, well, I appreciate it, you being on and helping to promote the Roswell conferences. I've been working with Peter Robbins on this for the last 2-3 months. In fact, he'll be my guest next week.
Peter's a very, very, he epitomizes the term gentleman.
Oh, I agree. He's got a heart as big as all outdoors.
Yeah, you but look up the word gentleman in any dictionary, and there's a picture of Peter standing right there.
Oh, I agree. But unfortunately, we're all out of time.
Okay, well, until next time, thank you very much, and it was a great pleasure and an honor to be with you.
And I appreciate it. You have a good evening.
You too.
And I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all those who joined us in the Palpac Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be author Carl Johan, and I believe it's pronounced Kalaman. And join me again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, where my guest will be Peter Robbins. And he is helping to organize and coordinate the Roswell conferences for 2008. So please check out his website at www.roswellmysteries.com/UFO. And until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.